This is Shanti Ashtangi from Madonna's 1998 CD Ray of Light. The album, which featured a Sanskrit pop song, went platinum 4 times. That same year, the apparel store Lululemon, which specializes in selling expensive yoga pants, opened its first shop in Vancouver with the mission of, quote, elevating the world from mediocrity to greatness. FY10, that chain brought in $483 million from approximately 150 stores worldwide. That's a lot of $98 yoga pants. Much has been written about yoga's popular and financial success, but little is known about its history in the United States, maybe even by those who practice it. Stephanie Simon charts that surprising evolution in her book called The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
Now, we think of yoga mostly as a form of exercise, but was it ever a religion?
Well, yoga has traditionally been very much a spiritual practice and, technically speaking, part of 3 world religions, Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism. When it first came to this country, Americans very much understood it as a spiritual practice that would get them closer to God, however they conceived it.
Now, it came here in the 19th century?
Yes. Scholars have argued pretty convincingly that the first American yogi was Henry David Thoreau. And he
was doing this in Walden? Walden Pond?
Theory goes he was reading Emerson's books, Sanskrit books about yoga, and he went to Walden Pond to practice yoga. It's a pretty credible case. He was certainly reading those books. He was certainly deeply, deeply influenced by them. And he really did try to meditate, and he understood himself as an aspiring yogi. He had a problem, though, which was that there were no teachers here, so no Indian teachers of yoga. So he was trying to figure out how to practice yoga with just from books that are very coded and symbolic and difficult to understand without a guru.
So he was a self-taught yogi.
Yes, and in that way, very American, I think.
We have no idea whether he was doing anything that remotely resembles what today's Ashtanga studios are teaching.
Well, certainly he was doing a meditative form of yoga. Much of yoga doesn't look like much from the outside. It's a meditation. The yoga you see in studios today is hatha yoga, and that's the one that has the postures and puts much more emphasis on physical purification. But the postures are only one part of that, and that's the part that we've really developed here in America.
The calisthenics part.
Yes, although that also came from developments in yoga in India in the 20th century as well, and people like Krishnamacharya and Swami Kuvalayananda.
Well, you said that what Thoreau was doing was a particularly American brand of yoga. Wouldn't the fact that much of the spiritual aspect of yoga has been eliminated in the practice in the United States also be a particularly American thing?
Well,
wouldn't that have made it more acceptable to most Americans who have different religions?
It depends on what era you're talking about. In the 19th century, people were less focused on physical fitness in the way that we are today. I mean, and certainly when they encountered yoga, it was taught as a way, some sort of experience of divinity, but also if it was advertised for anything beyond sort of God-seeking, it was sort of control of the mind and your mental and obtaining sort of mental powers. But again, that was a moment where people were looking for alternative spiritualities, I would say, and Buddhism kind of came over at about the same time and was met with great interest by Americans. So it really wasn't until later in yoga's history here that this sort of transformation from this kind of full-blown, complicated spiritual practice with different branches really happened into more of a fitness, and that was in the middle of the 20th century.
It became mainstream because so many Hollywood stars practiced it. Gloria Swanson, Greta Garbo did hatha yoga in the 40s. Martin Sheen, Raquel Welch took Bikram in the 70s. Madonna, more recently, when she isn't practicing Kabbalah. We have any idea why yoga is so entwined with entertainment?
Well, I think, you know, the first reason was that when it really started to catch on in Hollywood in the early 50s, it was very much being presented as a way to stay fit and healthy. And so, and there was a famous teacher, Indra Devi, who attracted a lot of these A-list Hollywood stars, including Gloria Swanson and Jennifer Jones. And so it became everyone's beauty secret. And it was kind of at the time marketed as sort of gentle and relaxing and an alternative to kind of traditional calisthenics with a little bit of this spiritual flavor, a little bit of this exoticism. But people really did see it as an efficient way to stay fit. That has stayed true. And obviously, Hollywood actors and actresses put a great premium on staying fit and to staying young looking. And yogis really developed a science of immortality, but the side effect was they really developed all these anti-aging techniques.
Well, there were all sorts of other exercise regimens. Jane Fonda was doing her workouts. Was she drawing upon yoga?
Jane Fonda, actually, I think her workouts, particularly the aerobics, for a period of time displaced yoga in the 80s. I think yoga kind of faded from the cultural view in the 80s, even though people were still practicing. But then in 84, she released her workout video that everyone remembers. And in 94, she released her yoga video. So there's a lot of debate about whether traditional calisthenics draw on yoga or the reverse, whether yoga draws on traditional calisthenics. But I think that it just was gathering so much steam culturally by the mid-90s that Jane Fonda put out her own video.
Weren't people kind of suspicious of yoga as another one of those Eastern cults that went along with TM? In fact, in the 70s and 80s, we had all of this fear of kids going into cults.
Oh, it wasn't just suspicious. I mean, they were certain that it was a cult. And the Hare Krishnas, I mean, they actually practiced bhakti yoga, which is the yoga of devotion. And as many people remember, there were all sorts of conflicts with the Krishnas and parents insisting their kids had been essentially kidnapped and then kidnapping them back to, quote-unquote, deprogram them. There was, at the same time, other yoga teachers, the teachers who were teaching Hatha yoga, had to work very hard to distance themselves from, you know, this understanding of yoga as a cult and yoga as something for just dirty hippies.
But if you only practice the asanas without the meditation, is it still yoga?
That's a really good question. It depends on what you believe they're doing for you. I think if you believe that they are kind of not only just giving you a fit body and toned muscles, but really moving the energy around the subtle body, which many people are familiar with the chakras that line the spine. And the real goal of Hatha Yoga is to move energy up the subtle body, up the spine, into the top chakra. If you believe that even if you're just practicing the poses, they are moving that energy, I believe it's still yoga. And you always kind of have created the opportunity of deepening the practice.
My guest is Stephanie Simon, S-Y-M-A-N, who was a founder of Feed, an early award-winning web magazine. She's written for the Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, Vogue, and Yoga Journal. And she's written a book called The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Today, students don't just practice yoga. You have to choose between styles founded by Iyengar, Bikram, Forrest, among others. How did these schools split from the traditional lineages?
Well, I think yoga, especially yoga in America, has always included a huge amount of invention. So there are teachers that came that may have been with the lineage or may not have been, and they market themselves depending on if they're really wanting to invoke tradition. So Bikram actually is part of a lineage in India. Other schools developed because American students were inspired by a number of different traditions, and they didn't want to hew to a single one. But I think there is a lot of invention in India as well that we're just not as aware of, even in the 20th century.
Bikram was an all-Indian national yoga champion. So yoga can be competitive?
Yeah, it was his guru who started the yoga competitions in India. Yes, I mean, that's certainly – I'm not sure that's yoga in the way that we understand it as something that is gearing you towards your own spiritual liberation. But certainly the physical forms, you know, there is a competition. And that, again, that's not an American product. That's Indian grown.
And you say Bikram also reinserted the religion into yoga. Well, since there's no chanting or meditation, what is the religion there?
Well, what I really think happened –
other than you have to practice in 105-degree Fahrenheit –
right.
Temperatures.
I think what I mean by that is simply that to practice Bikram yoga or even Ashtanga yoga, which I also mentioned, the yoga that Patabi Joyce taught, requires such a level of devotion and piety because it is so physically demanding. It is sort of a religious experience. It's not, in Bikram's case, he does not invoke any deities. There's no chanting. The talk in the class is very body-centered, but it kind of creates a disposition, a very devout disposition, because it's impossible to sustain that practice without it.
Why does it have to be in such a hot environment?
Well, it's funny. It got hotter as his school grew. His first location in Los Angeles in the bottom of a bank building in Beverly Hills wasn't so hot, and they had to have some heaters. I think I understand it to partly mimic the conditions in India, and that the heat really does help purify the body.
Yoga has now become a mainstream interest for a couple of decades. YellowPages.com lists 424 yoga outlets in New York. Compare that to 266 Duane Reade's. So we're seeing a major explosion, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's an explosion that's, you know, built on 150 years of history here. But sure, it's definitely a second boom, and it seems to be very much here to stay.
Well, how much does a typical class cost these days?
I think it ranges from, you know, $10 to $20, depending on the studio and depending on what kind of card you know, if you have a pass for the month, then that lowers the price. And there are donation-only classes.
And what do you think practitioners in India or Tibet might say about that?
Well, it's hard to generalize. I mean, there's different schools of thought. In India, there is a different tradition around yoga, including, you know, free classes. But you also would give everything you had to your guru.
Well, exercise can also be damaging. Do teachers have to prove a knowledge of kinesiology before they lead a class?
It really depends on what school. There are different teacher training programs. I mean, there was a whole a conflict around this idea of certification and regulation by New York State recently, and there are certainly some certifying organizations, but it really varies from school to school.
A caller just called in to say that yoga postures are being patented. Do you know about that?
The Indian government is fearful of American attempts to copyright and patent yoga, although nothing in America has been patented, no postures. So there's talk of patenting yoga postures in India to protect their traditional knowledge base, which they feel is being kind of unfairly exploited.
Okay. I just can't imagine that you could patent something like that.
It seems kind of challenging to me. It would seem to run into all sorts of practical problems.
Well, what are your thoughts about the commodification of yoga? Do Lululemon's $98 yoga pants kind of miss the point?
You know, I think that's what we do with things when in America. You know, when something becomes popular, we figure out every possible way to profit from it, in a sense. And so yoga in that way is no different. And it's not entirely new either. I mean, in 1963, there was a 7-Up ad in Life magazine in which, you know, people were doing yoga. So I think the commercialization, the commodification, is somewhat inevitable. I think it's clearly not the point of yoga, and it would be sad if people got distracted by this.
Well, I would assume that most people who are practicing yoga in this country are in a wealthier demographic. I don't know whether there are a lot of poor people practicing it, but in a sense, it is a free practice.
Yes. Well, the 2 points to make there. First is that yoga has always at first been the province of middle class and upper middle class Americans, people with time and leisure and money. But lately there have been some pretty strenuous efforts to bring it to poor Americans and people who have less access to such things. And all you need to know is have a decent teacher and learn a little bit to set you on your way.
Well, if you type yoga industry into Google, you'll get all kinds of estimates for how profitable it is, but they're all in the billions of dollars. Which suggests that some people, anyway, are trying to buy their way into enlightenment.
You know, I don't know how seriously they believe that buying the $98 Lululemon pants is going to get them enlightened. They probably think they're good pants and they look good in them. But I think that finding enlightenment always requires finding a good teacher and probably lots of hard work.
You're from Los Angeles and you live in Brooklyn. I assume you practice in Brooklyn. Have you noticed any differences between Los Angeles, Brooklyn, and Manhattan studios?
Well, to be honest, I practice in Manhattan. You know, I think each studio kind of develops a culture of its own and a sort of community of its own. And so They are different, and I think it's partly depends on who frequents them, and I think it changes over time. I've seen my studio change, you know, as people get older, you know, there are older people now there. As people have kids, they come and go more, and then there's a whole new generation of young students, so.
Wasn't there an unsuccessful attempt to require New York State teachers to be certified?
Yeah, there was a whole uproar around certification and licensing. It was the state coming in and trying to regulate yoga teacher training programs, and the New York teachers resisted.
Just one more thing. The title of your book is The Subtle Body, not The Supple Body, but S-U-B-T-L-E. Is that something that some yogi once talked about?
It's very much a part of Hatha Yoga. The subtle body is the sort of spiritual anatomy of chakras that line the spine. And so it's kind of central to yoga, and it really is a theme that I thread through the book about how various teachers talk about this and how it's presented at various eras in America.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard, for having me.
Stephanie Simon, S-Y-M-A-N, her book, The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.